to order, and today we're having a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 5053, the Oregon Department of Transportation. Ms. Jordan, you wanted to make some comments before we get started? No comments? Okay. Today we have invited testimony. None of the persons invited so far have shown up. However, Greg Wolf, the governor's policy advisor for land use and growth, I'd like to have you come up and give a brief presentation. We'd like to keep it fairly short this morning, and the reason is that we're going to start in on the base budget process this morning, and it's going to be quite time consuming.
Thank you, Senator Hannon, members of the committee. Senator Hannon asked me to come in and just give a quick overview of what the Community Solutions team is about, and also just talk about the Livability Initiative very quickly. I think that, and he also asked me to come back as we deal with the individual budgets that will come before this committee to talk about elements of those as well that tie together. The governor created the Community Solutions team shortly after he took office, and that is composed of the five directors that deal with growth issues: the Department of Economic Development, Department of Transportation, the Housing Agency, Land Conservation Development, and the Department of Economic Development. He believes that a lot of the systems that we have, a lot of the government systems we have today, don't do a very good job of integrating agency programs as they relate to local government. He's heard for a long time a lot of complaints from local government that state agencies don't speak with one voice as they work with local government and regions around the state. And he thinks that we can do much more to focus our work on solving problems rather than focusing on running the programs of these different agencies. We did a couple of pilot projects, one in Representative Butler's area for Ontario, siting of the prison, and one on the Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland to revitalize the main street there. And those two pilots really were quite successful in that it brought together these agencies to work together with the local jurisdictions that were involved, along with the community and the private sector, to solve these problems, the two problems being the 25% increase in the growth of the Ontario region and in the MLK Boulevard situation, needed revitalization of a main street. And in both cases, what we found is we had to have all those agencies working together to deal with the different elements of those problems. And the revitalization of Martin Luther King Boulevard, the problem was a median that went down the middle of the highway there that prevented on-street parking. We had some brownfield sites that needed to be cleaned up in order to get new development in that area, and we needed to revise some programs that prevented participation in loans on buildings that would allow for mixed-use development there. So it really took all those agencies working together to solve that problem. During the interim, Brent Wilcox, who is the chair of the Economic Development Commission, worked with a work group, an interim work group that had legislators on it as well as citizens, and they looked at the whole community development agency setup, and they also recommended that we had to do more to coordinate agency work. So they endorsed the Community Solutions team approach, but they also recommended that we set up regional teams around the state so that we had agency teams that were on the ground in each of the six regions of the state working with local government to do a better job of focusing on the problems that were there. Our objective in the whole Livability Initiative is to try to find some non-regulatory approaches to problem solving that don't rely on try to use the investments that the state makes in these places to do a better job of addressing concerns and making more effective and efficient use of the few dollars that we have in the sewer and water systems, transportation systems, to make them go as far as we possibly can. One example of this has been the work of the Community Solutions team to try to keep grocery stores located in downtown areas as much as we possibly can by helping them with transportation improvements and other improvements in the community downtown area that will make them more likely to stay there, thereby using the existing infrastructure rather than creating new infrastructure costs to serve them. One thing I think we've learned in this committee is talked about it is that you've got to have some kind of way to resolve the conflicts that exist, not only between state agency programs, like between the Department of Transportation and the Land Conservation Development Commission, but also conflicts between the state and local level in getting through these issues. And one thing that we think we've got to have in the design of this new program in the future is some way to get those problems resolved, get the people at the table that need to be there to work through disputes and then choose a course of action and get it either a yes or a no, or under these conditions, this particular project and this investment would work. So I've had several conversations with Representative Patrick, who is very concerned about that issue, and we're going to try to design some features into this thing that would actually give some clarity and certainty that those kinds of issues will be resolved using this process.
Are the community solutions team going to be empowered to say yes or no? And because one of the frustrating things reading is that you get a group of people together and they all individually say, I agree in principle, but I got to run it through my regional manager and the district manager and the chief of staff and the assistant to the deputy and the deputy. And by that time, everybody's just getting all strung out.
Senator Hannon, that's been one of our big concerns, and we've talked about this with the directors of those agencies, and we believe that unless we can do that, this process won't work. And we've found that we've got a situation now where DEQ, for example, says that either their person is empowered to make the decision on the ground, or they're going to be one phone call away from a decision from the somebody in the agency. So it's a completely different way of organizing these agencies and getting them to respond to these issues, because the way the current system is set up, you do have several layers before you get down to the person that's actually on the ground dealing with these problems. And it's a flaw that we think we've got to correct.
Do you have any more comments, Representative Schrader?
How about, I am concerned we're not really redoing how the agency works or bypassing how the agency currently works to make it hopefully slightly more effective. And I understand there's a variety of reasons we may or may not want to go that direction at this point in time. But I am very concerned about the request for 19 people. I don't think that's reasonable given the number of FTE in a couple of the agencies. And I'm sympathetic with the chair thing about where the level of accountability is. And I think it's important for the legislature at this point in time, before a package is approved, that we know who those responsible people are. I guess my thinking, or trying to come up with a reasonable sense, there are two small agencies involved. They don't have a lot of personnel. That would be DLCD and the housing people. So the idea of having four additional FTE to make this work in those two agencies, I could see. That makes sense. DEQ certainly does not need any new people. If they cannot find the people within their existing agency, I'd probably be very strongly against this particular package. I think they should have been doing this all along, quite frankly. And as to the six other people, my suggestion would be, and I don't know if you've talked about this at all, but you have the deputy directors. Add that to their responsibility. And that would be, you get at the accountability person, you'd have that person that you know has the authority. They would be the second, you know, basic link to these teams that are roaming the state and these regional partnerships. And if you have federal money coming through the transportation budget, you have that to pay a portion of their salary or a portion of their staff that's needed to do that. But we don't add any new people. We have the right people doing it that should be accountable. And the legislature and the citizens, okay, the deputy director of transportation, DEQ, housing, whatever, or the director, if that's the way you want it, is the responsible party. So we all know who to look to when these decisions are finally made. Has there been any discussion along those lines?
Well, Representative Schrader, we meet with the directors of these agencies every 2 weeks, and so they have ongoing discussion about how to actually make this work, because it is a big change in the way they do business. And I think we fully concur with your view that a couple of these agencies have sufficient staff that they don't need to add new staff to do this. And those two are the Department of Transportation and the Department of Economic Development. They both have oriented their staffs, and they are going to reassign staff to do this work around the state within their existing budgets. As you mentioned, LCDC and the Housing Agency are very lean and are not oriented to the field sufficiently to do this kind of work, and so we believe they need additional help. The Department of Environmental Quality, this has been an issue that's come up several times. A lot of people have concern with that particular new staff allocation. But in our discussions with the department, they indicate that their money, because most of it is comes from the federal government, comes with all these strings, they really are not able to de-link their staff from their traditional programs to this new task. Now, I think this requires, you know, I would welcome some more discussion between the committee and DEQ on this issue specifically, but they tell us that they cannot de-link from those traditional programs and put these people totally in a problem-solving, not linked to any particular program mode.
Yes, Rupert, you're sure.
Follow up and just a quick comment. Maybe the way to get at this is to use, if this money, C21 money, is allowed to be used for this particular type of project, to have that money flow in and pay the salaries or wages of those individuals that are linked to this, and we back out general fund money or whatever, general fund money that's in that budget and is paying those people now for other purposes. And I think that's more programs or for anything else that the department needs. I think that's the way to go about it, so we're not duplicating personnel, and yet we're using the money and allowing them categorically to use the money they're supposed to be using.
Representative Schrager, I think you'd have to have a discussion with DEQ because I don't know the intricacies of their budget, but it's my understanding they don't have a lot of general fund that is flexible, although I think that's a discussion that is really worth having.
Greg, if I could interrupt, I'd like to have the senator come up and give some testimony, so then we can take you back up if you don't mind.
Fine.
After that.
Thank you.
Senator Chairman, apologize to you for holding you up here this morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. I have a couple of handouts, and I think I'll give them to you when I leave. I'd just like to kind of bring, it was very interesting listening to Greg Wolf from the governor's office, and I'd like to share some of my concerns with you. When I first took over transportation, and then I realized what the overhead was and we need to do something about it, Senator Dirksler said to me, "Marilyn, the way we worked on workers' comp was we found out what it was in other states and we compared Oregon. And we looked all through the interim, and we tried, my administrator, we couldn't, because each state kind of categorizes different, and so we couldn't do it. But then, early this session, we found out about the University of North Carolina. And the University of North Carolina has a transportation studies department or program, and what they do is take all of the figures that the DOTs across the nation turn in to the U.S. DOT. And compile them. These are all ODOT figures. They're the Nevada DOT figures, Caltrans, California's, and they compare them. And this one that I'm going to leave with you shows that Oregon's administrative costs are the second highest in the nation. We're second only to New Mexico. And I just might add that New Mexico has the weight mile. The second is Oregon. We have the weight mile tax. Third is New York, and New York has the weight mile tax. It's a very, very expensive tax to collect. We have to send auditors all across the nation to go to trucking companies, and that's one and audit their books. And that's one of the things that caused me to look at this seriously. The first session, I was a firm believer that ODOT needed a gas tax increase. I wrote a letter to all my colleagues that ODOT needs a gas tax increase, and a mayor from one of the cities in my district helped me make it because their needs were so great. I changed my mind about that, and I do believe that I have good reason. One of the reasons is the program that Mr. Wolf was just here talking to you about. It used to be, and I think he said that started with this governor, but I thought that transportation growth management was carved out in 1993, but if Governor Kitzhaber, that's fine. But I think in the budget you'll see transportation growth management is about $50 million. That equates to the equivalent of a 3-cent gas tax increase. And what transportation growth management is in fact, in my committee, Senator Hannon said to the man in charge of it at ODOT, "You look familiar." where did I work with you before? Weren't you at DLCD? Yes, he said, I was. And what they got, what they have is they couldn't get enough to do all their land use planning in DLCD that they wanted to have done, so they moved them over, and they're taking it out of our gas tax dollars. And whatever they're doing, they may say, this makes it work better. We're going to have this interagency solving, problem solving. It's going to be great. But I'll tell you what it's costing us. It's costing us loads. Because $50 million, like I said, $58 million would build the Astoria Bypass. And so when we have all these transportation growth management, the frustration I heard that Representative Patrick was talking about would be solved in Senate Bill 773, because we heard the same thing about developers and about how that everything is there, the Woodburn. They've known since 93 that land was going to be developed and those outlet stores were going in. I don't know how many years we've known about the Oregon Garden, and 16 at Woodburn Interchange is not even on the strip. And that's going to cause all kinds of more congestion when that opens up in July. That they worked with the developer and told him exactly what he had to do. He had it all finished. Met with Woodburn, met with Marion County, met with ODOT in the last minute. ODOT said, well, you know what, I think it'd probably be better if we had another lane here or another whatever. He already is responsible for signage on the freeway that they needed to update anyways and all these other things. But we believe that 773, you have to make the decision, you have to tell them what they need to do, and then they have to stick by it. And so that's one of the things. I was looking to see if it was in here, but according, I don't see it, but to you, according to the audit they did in the interim, it's to collect the gas tax, I think it's $720 million they collect, and it's $14 million to collect it. To collect the weight mile, it's $400 and some million, and it takes $26 million to collect. It's a very expensive tax, and if we went to the diesel like 45 other states, we'd save a penny's worth of gas tax there. If we moved transportation growth management back to DLCDC, there's $50 million, and that's more than the equivalent of 4 cent gas tax increase. It isn't that they don't have the money to fix our roads, it's that their department has become something else besides transportation. The other thing that I'd like you to be very careful when you plan this budget. The word construction, it sounds good. We all want construction. So we saw that there was $759 million in one of the construction line items, because Mike Marsh is very good about giving us information when we ask. And so we've noticed that in the construction, it said that $759,000 for Westside Light Rail. And they will look you in the face, the current director, and say, we do not spend money on light rail. But if you were a developer and you wanted to develop some land and it impacted any highway or overpass, you know who would be responsible for fixing it before that land could be developed? You. But when Portland Light Rail, Westside came, they built a park and ride construction for it for $33,000. It says a park and ride lot construction. I'm going to read this. If I say it wrong, you can get it corrected. It's in here. Construction mitigation public outreach, whatever that is, but I think it has to do with the public relations firm telling them about Portland Light Rail. Construction mitigation employer outreach. Neighborhood traffic management devices, traffic monitoring counts, highway incident management equipment. Anyway, what they did all the signage for Portland Light Rail. The developer up here on I-5, Woodburn's doing his own signage, and we're making it very easy for light rail. The other thing about light rail that when you have work for the government, you have the trust of the people. And one thing and you have the trust of the assets that are under you. And back in the 70s, ODOT bought property for the 205 bypass. And in that bypass, there was enough right-of-way purchased for transit to build roads, because that's legal with the road fund money. You know, first off, the gas tax money is to go for roads, bridges, roadside rest area, 10% administration. And they bought, purchased enough to build lanes that transit buses could drive on. And that's fine because we can build the pavement. You can't buy the buses, but that money can. And so they built that, and all with gas tax money. And the federal government said at that time, you buy for an interstate and we'll reimburse your gas tax trust fund 92%. So all you'll be out is 8%. And so when the deal was made up there with Bechtel, a private company, ODOT's director said, the county and the city and support, they were all pitching in what they could to raise the money so Bechtel would build the right rail and develop land for very lucrative profit. And ODOT said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll give you the right-of-way. And then I found out about it. Some contractors came, and they showed it to me. So then we started asking questions. Then the answer was, well, you're going to have to pay 8% of it because 92% was paid with federal dollars, and there is a scheme we can work. Federal money, our money, that if it passes through the federal, we can it comes back flexible. We'll convert it into federal dollars. Well, I believe with all my heart, the ODOT director, I've never seen paperwork. I'd like to see the paperwork that said at the time the money didn't go back into the Transportation Trust Fund. And because it is allowed that you can use federal converted federal dollars more flexible than our gas tax money, that's the answer I'm getting. I even asked one of their lobbyists last night, why isn't the man that Bechtel, the company that's buying our right-of-way from our trust fund, why isn't that asset going back to the people of Oregon, the people that paid the taxes? All we need is about $3 million in Woodburn. It'd solve our problem. And they said, it's legal. It's legal. That was it. It reminded me of, pushing the envelope. I honestly, truly, I don't believe it is legal because at the time, I believe the money was put back into the trust fund where it was supposed to go in the 70s, and now we have just given that away. And I think that this committee, before you give them more money or see how they're spending it, you should look at the whole right-of-way situation. I was very surprised, shocked is a better word, to find out that we own the land on the roads from here to the coast and have owned the right-of-way since the 30s to widen the road to the coast to make it safe. We have, and between 51 and 54, we bought all the right-of-way from Corvallis on 99W up north of Amity to widen that road to make it safer. And I just think you should look at the right-of-way. We also, in out by I-5, I found out we were dealing with somebody in Polk County, and I started asking questions of the right-of-way man because a realtor has been bugging me about it, that ODOT parking right out on Market and I-5 is prime commercial property, and it's black topped over, and he said, I'm positive ODOT bought it. So I asked the right-of-way man that while he was in the office, and he said, yes, we did. And I said, tell me how it happened. There were businesses. What happened? He said, we paid to move Ashton, it was an international photo company. We moved, or we bought out Traxall Buick, didn't want to be there anymore. We bought him out and blacktopped it. If it was a park and ride so you could ride to Portland, it could have been three blocks from the freeway. They still own that property. I can't remember now if Transit pays them rent for it, but somehow it was for Portland Transit's in there someplace. But I think that if we have these assets that we're not going to build there, that we should transfer them in so we can build, or else quit buying property, because they told me last summer, July 21st, that they will not be building new roads in Oregon for 20 years. And in fact, I had the man say it twice because that was such news to me. And And I have documentation, because on this Portland Light Rail right-of-way business, and the questions that we asked to answer that. I just have a couple more concerns that I wanted to share, and that is Redmond, all they need is $5 million. They've raised $12 million locally, city, county, federal, and $5 million out of a $2.5 billion budget is not very much. And I'd like you to remember that from 1979 to 1981, the whole budget was $200 million. Now it's $2.5 billion. And I hope that you look into these programs that don't have to do with roads. They are there. The highway part is there to build roads, not to mitigate interagency disputes. And look very closely at this transportation growth management budget and see what it has to do with roads, because I think it's sucking up our road fund money.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Are there any questions?
Senator Shannon, do you know if Oregon Department of Transportation has a list of all of the right-of-way that they own?
Well, he said it would be very difficult to compile, but then he did write me a notice or gave that, because I asked, and he does know how much acreage they own.
The reason I asked that question is because I had tried to inquire of ODOT about selected pieces of property that they owned, and ran into some difficulty in being able to get
Did you talk to Al Leitner? Because he's answered all my questions, and he I think that if you could reach him, he would find it very.
And one other question, just about that right of way. Were you talking about? You said that since the 1930s we have owned additional right-of-way to the coast. Were you talking about around Highway 18 or 22?
Yes, 18. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Patridge.
I just want to entertain, besides the weight mileage is within the policy committee, and transportation growth management, obviously we're going to deal with here in terms of the funding piece of it. And then there's Senate Bill 773, which you mentioned. Then there's Senate Bill 86.
Yes. The reason that 86 is there, Earl Turner knows more about that. But the governor has set aside money, and part of it is in, I think, transportation growth management. If he wants to buy right-of-way of where they're going to build in about 20 years from now. And what they're trying to do is work with cities. They grant that money, our road fund money, out to cities and counties to help develop their transportation plan. It's an incredible amount of millions in plans. But anyway, because they want to figure out how their cities are going to grow back here at ODOT, then they're going to buy the right-of-way to where they're going to future build these. And it's not a bad idea if it wasn't costing us roads now. And the congestion is, since, I don't know how much it's grown since the transportation growth management has been in place, but I do know that the governor was comparing from 1982 to the present, and so Gary George has some pertinent information that he's going to share. And since they have all these problem solvers, congestion has grown by 300%. It's not working. We need to build roads. And I know the governor loves to say we cannot build our way out of congestion, yet they think we can build schools and build our way out of crowded schools, and it does work. You can relieve congestion. Sure, you could and I know it's an ugly word, and it sounds so weird, but I do believe they're using our transportation dollars for social engineering. They're trying to get us out of the cars and make it so miserable we'll all go to mass transit. And in fact, we'll scream for mass transit. But the money we're paying on our gas tax now, if it were going to roads and then what's left over to all this other, we would have roads. I do want to say another thing. The same University of North Carolina at Charlotte, said, their study, that Oregon has the 8th best roads in the nation. And in case you missed it in our paper, Marion County road people said our roads are 90%. And we talked with some county commissioners, and they said, actually, it's not the state, the county roads that are in disarray, it's the state. And the state has the money, they're just not putting it on the road.
Thank you. Representative, that
a couple things. First comment, I think there's a bumper sticker in North Carolina that says first in roads, last in schools. It's a very joke over North Carolina. But that's just an aside. You were talking about Redmond. You started talking about something in Redmond and then didn't finish.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Redmond, they want to do, okay, they have some pictures, and if they haven't been here, they should show them to you, of their town during when the trucks and the cars, showing their traffic problem right through town. They want a bypass. They desperately want a bypass. And they have gone to their own means, and they have asked for the federal dollars. They've gotten directly in there to Congress, and they have raised or committed local dollars. All together, they have $12 million, and all they need from ODOT is $5 million, and that's what they're asking for, $5 million, and I'm just saying ODOT's problems would be solved if we cut the transportation growth management business down to, you know, just reduce it by $5 million. You've solved all of Redmond's problems. And also, they have put into the mix, ODOT has the regional transportation growth management. And they came before our committee, and I asked them how many projects, after a year's working, the mayors, very, very busy people in this region, how many of the projects you seriously considered did you put forward, and they said 14. And I said, how many did ODOT put on the stip? And they said 2. So later, when the ODOT man from the region was there, I said, I noticed that you put 2 projects recommended. Do you think if you wouldn't have been in contact with the regional, local people, those would have been the top 2? Without question. We would have put those on whether they talked to them or not. And that's a whole other budget that is being spent on not roads, but all of this over-planning. And in fact, the people in my area are going one more time to the Oregon Transportation Commission this May. And if they are not put on the stick, they have 4 projects, one's $500,000, another one, very minor things. If they're not put on the stick, they're disbanding. And I don't know how ODOT will spend the money then.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. Representative Mike Lehman, welcome to the committee.
Chair Hann, members of the committee, I don't know that I've ever sat at the same table with Senator Shannon. I feel a little like I've been run over by a truck. I don't have the passion for this topic probably as she does, but I'm not really sure why I'm here other than Representative Montgomery told me that I was to come down here and testify today on this committee, so I follow his orders very well. I just wanted to touch on a couple of topics. I've been on the Transportation Committee for 2 sessions now, and I served the interim on the Transportation Committee. We spent a lot of time together. I was on a special subgroup dealing with Waste Mile. I've had a lot of dealings with ODOT over the last 2.5 to 3 years. A couple things. I also have the advantage of being term limited, so I can actually stand up and defend a state agency and not have to worry about the hit pieces that come out next campaign cycle. Despite that, I would say that if you look at ODOT as an agency, I've seen considerable growth in the department in the last 2.5 years. One is a recognition that the communication skills need to be improved in terms of dealing with not only this body, but members of the public. And second, I think an increased awareness of being accountable for what they do and being able to demonstrate they're accountable. Part of that process of being on the interim committee, we've made, you know, road trips. We've gone out to sites and looked at them. And I was struck last summer, Representative Montgomery took us to the Dalles, and we went up there and met with the ODOT crews in the Dalles that dealt with the gorge. We also met with representatives of Gillum County, and they detailed up there this very unique relationship they'd established where Gillum County, if I remember correctly, had a rock pit, and ODOT had the crushing equipment. or vice versa. But in any event, what they had worked out this arrangement whereby ODOT was getting their rock for their roads at considerably below the price they would have had to pay otherwise, and Gillum County was getting rock for their roads essentially free. They provided the rock in exchange for the equipment, and it was one of those synergistic relationships that worked out to everybody's advantage. I remember going out to the Salem Maintenance Department out here just off of State Street this session and talking to the crews, and these folks are energized by what they're doing. One of them showed us a piece of equipment that they had designed, and it was a grading equipment for the shoulders of the freeway, and they maintained this stretch of I-5, and they had developed this piece of equipment so that they could make this one trip along the shoulder of the road instead of having three pieces of equipment do the same thing. And they say they figured it would save them thousands of dollars every day because they could cut their equipment cost down. Those are things that I've seen, you know, anecdotally about how I think ODOT responds to things. On the broad picture, you know, ODOT is not perfect. I think you could go through any agency this size and find all kinds of issues of where they're spending money and how they're spending money. I think you can find judgment calls, things that you or I might say is a poor judgment. But when you look at the audits they went through, and I was on the committee that reviewed all those audits, when you look at the Blue Ribbon Efficiency Committee, and I was struck that I think Representative Patrick would know the guy's name, Peter Naums, Namas. I had the opportunity to have dinner with him this session when he described that report, and he said, I came in as an unabashed ODOT basher, that I didn't trust them, I didn't like them, I thought they wasted money, I'm a hardcore conservative Republican, I have never voted for a gas tax, I think they're innocent, have I gone far enough, so, I mean, get the picture, didn't like ODOT. He served on the committee and came back and basically said, and his quote I remember was, there's no smoking gun. There's nothing you can point to there as being a classic example of ODOT simply mismanaging. And he said, when I had dinner with him, he said, in fact, I've come completely full circle. I now support a gas tax, and I think you ought to let the agency operate. I think they're doing as good a job as you'd expect of them, and they're getting better. He also served with a gentleman from Klamath Falls, who I do not recall his name, who basically gave the same pedigree that said, I came in, absolutely did not like ODOT. He said the same thing in front of our committee. They are doing a great job. Again, I think he had some issues with the management that when you get to the upper levels of management, it's disconnected from the lower levels. I don't think you could ever get around all of that with an agency that size. One of the things that, I think we struggle with in this whole concept of access management, growth management when it comes to transportation, and I don't know that there's a good answer out there. I think ODOT is being forced into that issue to some degree, more than they probably want to be, and to some degree they're probably very comfortable with it. I'll give you a classic example in my district. You know, I'm in the Coos Bay area. Representative Messley has the Coquille Myrtle Point area. They spent about $3 million or thereabouts to do a bypass around the city of Coquille because it was a windy, curvy road to Highway 42, which is our access to I-5 through Roseburg. They did this bypass. They put it in. At the south end of the bypass, there is an area of property that the city wants to develop for some retail development. The problem is they need another access there. Well, there's a stoplight in one spot. The developers want to put a stoplight in down the street about two blocks. And it's stymied the development of that property, and I understand the people down there are very upset. People in my district are looking at it saying, okay, if we add a couple more stoplights, we've now negated the effect of saving time by the bypass because you've now put stoplight after stoplight in. It's one of those things. I don't know what the solution is. If you're living in Coquille, you want the stoplight and the access. If you're living in the Bay Area, you might very well say, you know, you can develop Coquille, but you're slowing us down, getting our goods and services to Willamette Valley. I sat on some committees, and I have heard attacks on ODOT that go far below anything I've ever experienced in my three sessions here. I literally heard a state senator, and not Senator Shannon, sit up there and say, and using this language, there is money laundering and slush funds in ODOT. And I thought at that point that we probably should advise Grace Clement and her Fifth Amendment rights to remain silent because those are criminal charges against an agency. I think it's very popular to beat up on them. I had some women in my office yesterday from my hometown, and they started in on ODOT. And I said, well, what are you talking about? Well, there was an urban renewal project where some planters were put into a section of my community. And one of the planters was put in a location right in front of a business. And it was a marina. And it prevented cars and trailers from going in and out of that marina. Well, they were attacking ODOT for it, where it was a city decision with the consent of the landowner that went awry. It didn't work out like they intended. They removed it. And they were pointing and said, well, that's an example of ODOT wasting money. All ODOT had said is, yes, legally you can put the planter there. You know, we're not going to make a judgment whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. You can put it there. And that's kind of what's gone on this session. Whatever happens, you know, I often said that, you know, when the new Carissa hit my beaches, that ODOT must have done something to make that happen, because that's kind of where we've gone this session. What's the question? The answer is ODOT screwed up. And I think there's plenty of room to look at what the agency has done. But overall, I have not seen massive misspending of money, diverting of funds, inappropriate activities. They certainly have room for improvement, but I just have not seen this egregious things that other people claim to have happened in the department.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lehman,
do you know what ODOT spends on administration?
Do I know what exactly it's on administration?
Yes,
yeah.
Okay. What region do you live in? What ODOT region?
Region 3, I believe.
We have a chart that we've been given in our committee here about the condition of roads and so forth in the state. And we've heard that our roads are in pretty bad shape. And we just heard from Senator Shannon about a UNC Charlotte study, which I got probably about the same time that she did, that really surprised me because it names Oregon as 8th in the United States, and we've been hearing from the Progress Board and from other folks about the terrible deterioration of our roads. But when I saw the chart that ODOT has given us on the condition of the state roads, basically there are only two regions in the state that are below 80%. And that surprised me, because some are way above. Your Region 3, you happen to be at least about 82%, it looks like here, maybe higher. So your roads seem to be doing fairly well. In Region 1, my roads seem to be doing fairly well. That's Region 2 and Region 4. Region 2 is below 70%, and Region 4 is at about 75%. So I think the averaging and looking at the condition of the roads is real interesting when you see the perspective of the chart where it shows where the roads are good and where the roads are bad. So there are things that basically are brought up in discussions, but if you don't have the full information it makes me question some of the numbers I see when I see that we're doing so poorly with maintenance of our roads, and when in reality it looks like two regions aren't doing very well. But I don't think anybody is really bashing an agency. I'm sorry to hear that you do, but I think that when we as legislators are supposed to be guardians of public funds, we should ask questions. That's what we're sent here to do. And so knowing what the administrative cost of an agency is, I think, is an important factor before really being able to defend everything that they do and how they use their money. So,
Sherry Ann and Q-Tab, I agree with what you're saying. And when I say I don't know the exact percentage of what the administrative fees is, I've looked at those budgets, I've seen them. The first thing you've got to do is to find what administrative expenses are and what that covers. The other part about it is that, you know, I'm just a poor country lawyer. I live out in rural Oregon. And you can bring in the studies you want, and you can bring in all these things that say, here's, you know, how good our roads are. I will tell you categorically that the roads in my district are in bad shape. I will tell you categorically that the Chamber of Commerce in my community has come out and said, we need better roads than highways. I will tell you that I can drive along sections of my highway where the roads are falling off the edge of the mountain because it's so much rain. The classic is about 10 miles north of Coos Bay. There's a section of highway where the guardrail is about 2.5 feet below the pavement. And it's pavement from below the guardrail clear up because it keeps settling. Now, that would be about a $2 or $3 million fix, I assume, to correct it because it drops off the edge. So we can pull the North Carolina studies, and we can pull all these studies. I will tell you that when I get on the freeway above Eugene, it's the modern highway because I can put it on cruise control, takes my hands off the wheels, and it will go down the rut. So, you know, again, I appreciate the fact we have these studies. I think most Oregonians will tell you categorically the roads in the state of Oregon are in bad shape and they're getting worse. And if you get out of the metro area and come on out to rural Oregon, we'll show it to you. And we'll show you those roads are stopping us on the south coast from developing. So I appreciate that study, and I know that facts don't lie. But I will also tell you real life experience will say there is a problem out there.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you just proved my point. We need more roads.
Well,
I don't know that you meant to say we need more roads, but Representative Lehman, did I understand you serve on the Joint Audit Committee? That's the committee that reviewed.
Sure, Hannon, Senator Dukes. No, I didn't serve on the Joint Audit Committee. We had the audit reported to us. We sat with them when the audits came back and listened to the reports that came in. On ODOT.
And that would be the Transportation Committee?
Yes.
Oh, okay, because I was going to ask, we had the audits, and we haven't really looked through them here, and I was wondering, what was your sense? I read through them, and I was surprised at the lack of glaring, you know, they're spending way too much over here, or they're way out of line over there. What was your sense?
Senator Dukes, no, audits, and 60 cents will get you a cup of coffee. Well, $1.10 will get you a cup of coffee. I mean, audits only tell you that what you ask in the first place. And so you have to go in with that understanding. If you look at these audits, it says that where they said they were going to spend the money and where they said they were going to do things, they did it. The audits do not say they're efficient, they spend the right appropriation monies in many cases. The audits say that there is nothing in there that's an egregious violation of law or egregious deviation from standard practices. I don't think you're going to go look at the audits and say, gee, it's a passing grade, they're doing everything correctly, because I don't think the audits look at that.
Okay. Good questions. No, thank you, Representative. Appreciate
thank you, Chairman.
Senator George, you've joined us now. Would
Can
you
I
like
ask a question to what senator he was referring to?
Yes, Senator George.
Yeah. Lead in, Mr. Chairman. If I could, let me put up some numbers that refer to what he just spoke about. And that is, this is related to a piece that I got from Jim Pitt relative to a question that was asked in Maryland Shannon's committee. In there, if you remember that first section of the audit, you may have it here, it said it was $887 million, which is this number, and then it showed that the total final amount of paid out to contractors was $378 million. So I asked the question, what happened to the $509 million? Now, that number does not appear on here, but the reason I'm showing this is this was the result of the answer to that question. We asked the question, what happened to $509 million? Okay, if that's a slush fund, I'm sorry, that was just a question. That question ended up resulting in an answer, and I'm going to deal with these answers as I go ahead and proceed here, if I could, Mr. Chairman. By the way, for the record, State Senator Gary George, District 2.
The only thing I'd question on, Senator, is we're under time restraint, so I want you to give your presentation, but if we can concise it down, because
right.
We're supposed to be on zero-based budgeting this morning.
Okay, I noticed that over 15 minutes was given to the representative, so I won't ask any of
yeah, I know.
That amount of
I
time.
Know. No, I want you to do your presentation.
We're gonna, well, and I've agreed to you this much. If you want to learn where you're going, you need to know where you're in, and if you look back here at this number, $199 million back in 1981-82, The reason that's important is because you need to watch how fast these numbers build. But also the factor is that back at that period of time, we were building roads. Here is a chart showing the total amount. This is an ODOT team from the GIFT team. So he's stating that of the public roads, ODOT controls about 8% of them. And I'm going to go through these a little bit fast, so you know, we'll just have to wait till we get to the end to ask any questions. This is right now reflecting what we know of the current revenues and what we're talking about with expenditures. I'm bringing up just a bit so people can see that. Total expenditures down here, city, county. Payments to contractors, 361 relative to roads, and I'll show you where that came from in just a minute. The maintenance budget, of course, in the new one is $305 million. Of that, the construction materials are $26 million that were actually relative to the roads. D&D operations of this month, if you total all these, they come up to $1.2 billion. Now, if you want to call that a slush fund, that's your little comment. I would never make a statement like that, and that it would be a slush fund. It's just a way of analyzing the numbers. Let's take a look at the construction budget itself. In that, this is, of course, going back and using the audited numbers, that isn't current biennium, $887 million. Of that, they spent $826. One question I asked early, why, if you claim that we have a backlog of maintenance and when the revenues are coming in above expectation, wouldn't you go ahead and spend what you have been allowed to spend? Very interesting question. The total amount that went out to contractors was $471. Mm. That included substantial dollars that actually went cities, counties, that sort of thing. But actually what went out, and this was from an audit that is coming up next, $361 million went out to all things relative to roads out of this amount, and the actual number that a contractor, and I have never had anyone refute this number, that actually about $200 million out of the $887 actually got to things relative to road construction. This is a piece I made reference to, and if you'll notice this number right here, I have two more copies this morning. $180 million for that period of time, and of course that was the total for construction right there. And what that amounts to is you take that number for the biennium and you end up with the $361 million number I was using. The total construction payments that came out of an audit that I believe Mike Marsh gave that to us showed that this amount, which is what went out for AC pavement, concrete bridge, and et cetera, $198 million. And there's an interesting number I found in here, and this is, I think you guys ought to look at it. Total change order, safety, sign, and mobilization, $98 million. A lot of money. The total spent on maintenance from the $1.3 billion annual revenue, only $13 million actually got out to buy the supplies for our maintenance crews. Which you notice down below, that's about 1% of the revenue. This is actually a list of the items. And this is, of course, a 1997 annual for probably $13 million. One of the things that's stated is it was short of money. So the reason that the number 1982 through 1995 was used is because that was what the governor's growth task force used. So we wanted to see during that period of time what had actually happened. These are the numbers out of that study, 18% population increase, 59% increase in vehicle miles traveled. So we're literally driving way more than we used to. So during that period of time, 378% increase in gross gas fuel tax collection. According to legislative fiscal, we had a 65% CPI, leaving a net increase in gas, 313%. What we yielded out of that was a 90.5-mile reduction in total miles of highway. And we got a 300% increase in congestion. I agree that the condition of the roads really isn't that bad, but what we're really suffering from is we're suffering from a condition that is called lack of capacity. And I'm going to give you guys an example. It doesn't apply to this right here, but just recently I was listening to the radio, and they announced that we were moving at peak capacity on Highway 5, 800 to 900 cars. Just the day before, I'd seen a number, I'd been watching a piece on 2020, and the same highway in Los Angeles was moving between 1,700 and 2,000 cars per lane per hour. And the question that has to be asked is, why were we moving less cars? And the answer is, the cars in L.A. were moving. And that is a little reflection of highway capacity. So you get more cars down the same lane per hour by moving. This is the number that was presented to us last session. You see, what they projected was 20% increase in population, 40% increase in GMT, and the answer that came out of ODOT to solve that problem was less reliance on auto traffic. If you think about the previous number, of actually 18% population growth and 59% increase in GMT, that isn't a conclusion that you should come to, that you're going to have less reliance on auto travel. So how have the other revenues been coming in? I don't know how many of you noticed this. This was a governing magazine, and what it indicates, if you look at the blue, that's us, and you look over here, 50 to 59% increase in annual average federal funding increase under T21. So we could expect substantial increase in revenue coming in. In fact, we're going to look at that in depth. It's $201 million. But what's happened during that same period of time that we talked about before, as far as the federal tax collection, because even though when we were receiving 87.5%, we were still receiving 87.5%. We went from 4 cents to 18.4 on diesel, from 4 cents to 24.4, and there's the increases during that period of time. Right now, US DOT tells that Oregon is receiving 100% at least of our dollars back. We've gone from a donor state to actually being a receiver state. That's a good thing, by the way. You need more dollars to come in. And there's what it looked like between the 97.99 and the 99.01 on the increase in the federal dollars coming in. $201 million. Now, if you remember the debate over the gas tax last time, one of the issues was whether they were flexible or not. This is a piece out of the, obviously, TriNet publication. And as you'll notice, they said that one half of those dollars were flexible. And, of course, they were happy about that because they could flex into transit in addition to highways. This is a piece that was presented to us last time from ODOT. And what this shows was is that we had, according to them, 22.2 million state funds headed to the other modes. And that's the number that you want to watch and take a look at. Now, if all this money is coming in and supposed to go in the roads, how could we end up with this happening? This is the Oregon Highway Miles, and you see the state in 1985, and here we are in 1995, 90.5 miles left. Okay? Recent poll taken by the folks over at AAA asked the question, do you favor or oppose the current restrictions that ensure that the money will be going for building, repairing, maintaining roads, highways, and bridges? Overwhelmingly, the people said, we want that money maintained there. I think if you'd remove constitutional and just ask the question without the constitutional part in there, I think you would have seen that number go up. People are nervous about the Constitution. This was a piece that we recently received talking about where the dollars go from the U.S. government returned to us. Federal Transit Administration average nationwide $15.50. What came back to Oregon? $50.60. So you can see we have a trend and an emphasis. For those who still maintain that we're not receiving any more money, this is revenue numbers that came out of the Oregonian, and you can see that was in July 12, 1998. 214.9% increase. During that period of time, less than 40% CPI increase. Interesting thing here is what the trucks, how we're taxing trucks in relationship to other states, because how we tax trucks affects what kind of money is coming into the treasury. As you can see, we tax them pretty severely. In fact, according to the Oregon Tax Research folks, it was $16,826. This is a piece from AAA indicating how we tax Oregon versus California. And of course, as you notice, this number 37.9, California claims that they're actually seeing at about 18.5.
Is that cost responsibility?
That's cost responsibility, yep. Now, this is the number that many of you have seen, because I think it gives you a trend. This was the projected number, and I'll show you the slide to substantiate that number. Some folks have challenged that number. It's a real number. This is what the projected was. So this was projected 95-97. This was projected 99-01. This is what we received when we first got here. $738 million under that scenario. And that did, of course, have borrowing in it. But interesting thing, the cities and counties, during that same period of time, these are absolute numbers, got a $58 million increase. Now, to back those numbers up, here's the actual plate from ODOT. You all recognize it. 2.087. here's the bubble chart again for MoDOT. You'll notice over in the underline right here, 2.825. Now, the expected budget came out with 2.582 billion, and even with that, over the 99, that was a $298 million increase on the low side. And of course, if you use the high number, 2.825, 541 million more. We started asking, why with these increases aren't you getting anything? And so I put together a little list of projects that we could do with just the increases. And of course, you recognize the $298 million, New Virginia Bypass, Highway 20 Bypass, Astoria Bypass, 217 Interchange, Highway 1822. Some of these aren't completion of the project, so get them well underway. Then if you go down and you drop to the $541 million, just taking the increase now, this is leaving the revenue, leaving the spending at the previous level, but if you just took the increase in revenue, what you're going to find out, you can do the following thing. Now, this number right here, that seems like a really low number, but that's actually an extension of the cost numbers that were done to repair Highway 5 overlap between Salem and Wilsonville. They did equivalent to 10 lanes because they did the 6 lanes plus the emergency lanes. It's a beautiful overlay. It looks great. If you extend those numbers out on the border to border, it comes out around $72 million. Now, you got to remember, just get that number in mind. I want to go back to that one that we had from Jim Pitt. There was a number called indirect support services that was in that first piece I put up. And that indirect support services, so just in the construction budget, would have paid for a border-to-border repayment using that scenario. Well, I compiled some numbers based upon different pieces that were given to us by ODOT, and here's what I found out. Now, the reason these time periods aren't the same is I used their numbers. So what I did was I compared what the gas tax increase was and what the net effect of that increase had been. You have this under pavement condition. You have a $70 million increase, 5% decrease in the quality of the road. Bridge condition, under that period of time that they used, $261 million increase in gas tax with a 16% decrease in bridge condition. Congestion, using the period of time that was there, you had a $272 million increase and a 3 times increase in congestion on certain roads. Some roads are worse than that. Okay, here's 88 to 97. The indication is that there is no more money, and this gives you what those revenues were back then. This gives you what they are now, and you can see how that actually works out. The actual increase was more than the total was in 1998. If you follow those dollars, how did they get spent? It looks like this. Fitting County, out of that annual revenue, got $231 million, which actually works out to be 17.7%, not 50. Balance after the share is this, available for new construction, $54 million. That's been a contentious issue this time, and we just passed out yesterday a bill that will try to move this number up. If you think about $54 million, new construction in relationship to $2.6 billion, that's a little bit of a startling number, this equals about 4% of the remaining, 5% of the remaining revenue. Again, we'll go back to this one. This kind of will sum it up. I know we're right on the time period here. Again, the total revenue, 2.6, city, county. Now this, of course, the computer lays this out in proportion, so you can look at this number. You look at right here where we are, and you come down to the material B&B operations, they total this. The question for you is, that you must ask, is where are we buying so little? And back to this one more time, because this really says it all. A massive increase in revenue, and part of the problem, if I could, how much time do I have left, you guys? I should be right on the...
You're right on the money.
Right on the money. Right.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay.
I won't interrupt you.
All right. I have a bunch more, but one of the things we need to deal with is finally addressing the problem. The equipment indoor and outdoor livable communities, it's very familiar to us, we're already dealing with that. This was from an article on Heritage Foundation. Interesting thing is, right here, how are we doing? Portland is already approaching New York in traffic congestion, yet New York is 15 times the population. Talking about the west side bypass, a freeway, things like that, that's where you get into it. 5 additional light rail lines, projections Portland traffic volume will still rise with the 5 by 50% within 15 years. one more, and I'll end it right here because it's kind of flashy. Two more if I can, and Bernstein's fudging it up a little bit. Nationally, commute speeds have increased by 20%, but not in our area. In the congested area of Portland, congestion in Portland area has grown faster than any western state because we are not doing something. And here's the kind of conclusions out of all that data that we're drawing, and that is new highways won't solve the problem. It's an amazing statement. And then actually in ODOT statewide congestion, the idea that unless Oregonians agree to substantial reduction in personal mobility, we have a problem with highway capacity. Again, the governor, we can't build our way out of congestion. And then this statement by ODOT, which is what I believe is a recognition of reality, roadway projects in general have a net effect of reducing congestion. And then let's ask the people of Oregon what they think about it. Question within Oregonia, is an Oregonian, which is closer to your viewpoint? Now, this was a push poll. They wanted this answer here to be this answer, but it turns out just the opposite. The people responded, we want more dollars spent on roadways than on public transportation. And again, the conclusion, I'm going to pick on that. I don't know whether you choose a vaccine in the city of Portland here, but Portlanders, this is from the project manager, Peter of Portland's Office of Transportation. Portlanders realize that adding more freeways does not relieve congestion, but adds to it. And again, ODOT's feeling about it, roadway projects in general have a net effect of reducing congestion. And you folks have a big job ahead of you because there's a lot of money that ought to be buying something. And if I could ask you just to think about this, when it came to that construction, if I go out and I pay $26,000 for a car, or equivalent to $22.6 billion, $26,000 for a car, and I go to pick that car up, and I realize that, that I'm only getting about $3,600 worth of car, I'm a little upset that I paid $26,000 for it. Those are the proportion of numbers and what you need to be looking at. I thank you for the time. I'm sorry I was so rushed.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions by committee members? Senator Dukes.
Jerry, you led us up to we ought to be looking for where the money's going. I'm assuming you spent a lot of time on this. I'm assuming you have some ideas as to where the money's going. Could you share that with us?
Let me see if I can find it really quickly. And it came from the audit. And because we look at numbers, I think that was right here. We look at the numbers that came, here. Right. These are the numbers from the audit. And Joan, I think you were talking to Community College when I asked Mr. Guy this question. what you have is payments to contractors. This was the total amount that was there, and the payments that was alleged, that's really your immaterial. But let's come on down here to the bottom, and let's break that down. We're construction account. Well, $283 million. Actually, if you track that through and take all the numbers from the initial 887, there's actually $350 million that is not clearly defined where it goes that actually goes back into ODOT operations. But here's the interesting thing. In addition to this question that I raised right here, is there was $1.584 million that was paid to contractors for consulting. We also had $880,000 in that same audit that went to payments for environmental studies. Yet we have a piece in the file that says that, of course, according to ODOT, that we spent about $60 million for consultants. But that's not the main point here. If you look at the net amount after the $61 million reduction in right-of-way, and in other words, this number and that number equals this number. If you take that out, because that's right-of-way, actually what we get ODOT's operation out of the construction budget. Then you add stuff like transportation development and central administration, you end up with a $410 million number. Now, to understand that number, you have to remember that you only got $471 million out of contractors. And actually, the number, according to ODOT's own audit that was done for the Waite Mile study, was $361. So if you use the high number, that means that you spent $410 million to actually get $471 total out of contractors. And that means that you spent 85.48 cents for every dollar you got out to the contractors. The other day, Senator tried to blame the contractors for the cost. You've seen by the graph the contractors are not getting these dollars. That only leads you one conclusion that you have to draw, and I'll let you draw that conclusion.
Senator,
thank you.
I just like this one part of the statement about this. My name is Marilyn Shannon, for the record, Senator, District 15. And my husband is a school business official, and we live in a small town one time, and I was a little upset with what was going on at City Hall, my friend. And he said a very profound statement. If you want to know how a public agency is spending their money, you don't look at how it's budgeted, but go down and look at their canceled checks. So that's what we did. And if it says, for instance, construction, we asked them, how were these construction dollars? They spent $3.5 million competency training. I don't know what that is. I know they've stopped the daycare now because last session we got into the daycare situation. In fact, that situation in the auditing, the auditors asked the Attorney General 7 questions. Is it a legal use of road fund money for daycare? That answer came back, probably not. Now, who's going to make the trust fund whole? There's not even been an attempt. Federal dollars are flexible. In San Francisco, they have a daycare center and a BART center. They did it with federal transportation funds. The misappropriation of gas tax money can be made whole back in from flexible federal dollars. But if I were sitting where you are, I would not look at how the money is going to be spent and say and imagine that construction means concrete and concrete. I would look at how in your packet it's there. When we asked for a breakdown of Westside Light Rail, this is what we received. But I would look at how the money had been spent last time to see where you might get to this time. And to answer your question, you weren't here, Senator Duke. I think it's $50 million in your budget for transportation growth management. Move it back to LCD. That's the equivalent of a 3-cent gas tax increase. Penny brings in $16 million. Go back to the weight mile, repeal the weight mile, that's a $16 million saving. Right there you have over 4 cents. It's not that they don't have enough money, it's what the priorities are. And I think they should get back to the roads, and every question should be, how does this help lay pavement? How does this help repair the coastal highway? How does this help repair the roads? Then if we have money left over, it can go to all that other stuff. Thanks.
The chart that you put, the question that was asked was how much was spent on construction, so you asked for the breakout of what was said to be construction money on Westside Light Rail. Was that
right? I'm at a disadvantage because my assistant does most of these questions while I'm in committee, and he has sick and didn't help me prepare, but that's exactly what happened. We asked for the construction dollars, and we noticed what was spent. And when we saw Westside Light Rail, we said, would you please give us a breakdown of that Westside Light Rail? And this is it. And I agree, it didn't buy rail track. It didn't buy a rail car. But it accommodated, and they put it under Westside Light Rail.
Okay. One more question?
Yeah.
Thank you. 1 cent bringing in $60 million.
Yes.
Just for you or biennial?
Well, it just brings it in. So
in 2 years or 1 year?
It's two years. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Representative Jane Loken has submitted written testimony that will be inserted into the record and made part of the record. Greg Wolf from the Governor's Office, if you want to come back up and make any more comments.
Want to follow that one?
Excuse me. Go ahead.
Well, Chair Hannon, I think I've concluded my remarks from before, so I guess I'm just answering questions. I guess one thing I just respond to relative to the prior testimony relative to the relationship between planning and transportation planning, that our comprehensive plans around the state are about 20 years old now, and as we update them, as we need to do to accommodate new growth throughout the state, the location of that growth and how that growth occurs is going to have very substantial impacts on our transportation costs. And I think just one example that's been used quite a bit in the past by the governor is the Bend Bypass, where had we been able to control access on the first bypass that was built in Bend, we would not have had to build a bypass to bypass that bypass, which cost us $125 million. And that's, I think, just an example of the kinds of costs that you can run into if you don't think about planning and growth management at the same time we think about where we're going to put our new transportation facility.
I have a question because you brought up bypasses. Other fairly major cities in the United States, don't most of them have an outer belt or a bypass that they've built in their planning?
Chair Hannon, Senator Q-Tub, I think most jurisdictions do have facilities that are meant to carry traffic around cities, and I think that and the governor believes that we need facilities that can move traffic through and around cities. The problem is that if we take those kinds of facilities and we turn them into local streets, they defeat the purpose that they were built for. And so that's our issue. We want to make sure that when we build and make that kind of investment in a facility that's meant to move traffic through an area, that we protect it rather than put it in a condition where the traffic slows to 25 miles an hour and it doesn't function in that way, and we would have to build another facility to accomplish that purpose.
And I know part of that is the access to allow access and ingress and egress. But I will say that in the Portland metropolitan area, Highway 205, it is my understanding that that portion was actually supposed to be linked all the way around eventually. I mean, that's only a piece of bypassing Portland area. And if it were ever linked together, it would create four the Portland metropolitan and Tri-County area a way to get around all of the traffic that's inside, like 99 and Tualatin Valley Highway and 26.
We wouldn't have to go to Portland anymore, huh?
Right, and go around.
Then there it is.
So, how do you justify transportation money being spent at DLCD, given four grants for projects only peripherally related to transportation?
Chair Hannon, Senator Dukes, we believe that the extent to which we can reinforce downtowns and main streets and prevent strict commercial development along state highways, we will be able to save transportation costs. So that's the philosophy of using the federal transportation money, because you can't use the state gas tax for that purpose because it's constitutionally limited. But the federal gas tax is flexible enough to be used in that way, and there are some funds that are used that way currently. The $50 million figure that was mentioned previously, I don't believe has a basis in the budget, and I think that I'd ask you to check in with Director Krennican about that.
Do you have a list of criteria for what these grants are based on, or anything that, for example, if it's not going to be directly related or even closely related to transportation, does it have to be something that would there otherwise be located as part of a strip development so that, looking at what's going on, I don't see a relationship. Is there something in writing that says to the people who are making the decision to give the grants that there better be a relationship?
Chair Hannon, Senator Dukes, I think that LCDC does have and the Department of Transportation does have criteria they apply. You're talking about the Transportation Growth Management Program, right? That they do apply to those grants that go to cities and counties to do that kind of planning work. Mainly those grants are used to do transportation system planning work. That's the bulk of the funds that are used in that program. But then there are the other elements of that with response to the quick response to particular development issues that is also used there. But Elsa, I would ask you to direct that question to Dick Venner, the director of the LCDC, and Grace Krennican, because they do have a list that because they have to go through an application process in order to receive one of those grants.
Sure, I'd be curious to see just where in that list of criteria transportation actually falls, since it is transportation money.
Well, we'd like to have Mr. Venner come in and maybe give some comments to in regards to what the role and mission is that they anticipate will be, so we can help identify some of those funds.
Still having trouble with his employee who said Safeway is my client.
I don't know.
This is
DLTD.
Oh, I was a meeting in Garibaldi.
Okay. Representative Patrick?
I just want to say for the record, I talked to Mr. Bush several times in regards to the community solution team that we've talked about. We've gone through many iterations, and I, just for the record, I think the community solution teams are a good idea. I think they will work well, but I'm concerned about the additional FTE and the additional dollars that are going to be spent like everyone else. I asked a list of projects to see those, and Drake's working on those. In terms of, you know, what are these community solutions really going to do that justifies them being in here? And two, I'm looking for the form of how the community solutions are going to work together, and also the question that we've asked here about the authority issue. In terms of what kind of authority are they going to have, or are they just going to be another layer, another governmental layer? Greg yesterday and continue to be that. I see these community solutions teams as coming into local communities to solve specific problems. I think that that's part of how they were intended to do that. But I'm not prepared to go forward until I get some of those questions answered. You talked about a strike force kind of thing. Instead of having five regional community solution teams all over the state, to put some people who have some authority into maybe a strike force or a handset that we go out and solve a community, help solve a community's problem, but have the full force and authority of the governor's office to come in and work with us. So I'm interested in the ideas. I think that they've done some good things around the city, and I just need some justification.
Okay, further questions? No, thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing work session on the invited testimony and move to the Board of Maritime Products Budget Overview. It's a continuation from yesterday. Linda Gilbert and Susan Johnson, would you both come up, please? Linda Gilbert's not here. Okay. Susan, I guess you're flying solo this morning.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Well, recovering from the mad dash from the parking lot. For the record, my name is Susan Johnson. I'm the administrator for the Board of Maritime Pilots. I wanted to clarify a few things from our discussion yesterday. Regarding the makeup of the board, despite its name, the Board of Maritime Pilots is not made up of maritime pilots. There are three pilots on the board representing three pilotage grounds. There are three industry members who represent the shipping community, and there are three public members who have not had any interest or pecuniary interest in shipping or pilotage at all. Often they come in knowing absolutely nothing, and sometimes it's a real long learning curve for them. So.
Excuse me if I can interrupt.
Sure.
The Senate convenes in approximately 10 minutes.
All right, I will be happy to entertain questions.
What I'd like to do is to try to concentrate on the budget. We went through this presentation yesterday, and we're refiling the same ground, and we don't have that much time to do it in, but I would certainly ask you to concentrate on any of the decision packages or things you feel might be relevant for us to deal with.
Well, Mr. Chair, fortunately, our budget is quite simple, unlike many of the issues that we deal with. The budget is based solely on the license fees that the pilots pay to renew their licenses and obviously get a new license. Those fees have not increased in years, and we do not intend to increase those fees. The board has been operating with leftover budget, unexpended revenues from biennium to biennium. I believe that if this trend continues, if we continue to experience budget excesses, that I would suggest the board reduce the license fees.
What is the current fee?
It's $1,500 a year.
Okay. And what is your approximate surplus now? How many months?
I believe for this last $97.99 biennium, it's estimated to be $16,000 left over.
And are these monthly renewals, yearly renewals?
Annual renewals.
And they all take effect on, like, January 1st?
No, Mr. Chair. They're actually effective upon the date of inception of each licensee. So we have varying numbers of renewals every month.
And how many licensees do you have?
At this current time, Mr. Chair, we have 66 pilots.
66 times 1,500.
We operate on a budget of approximately $200,000 for the biennium.
Represent the package.
Sir, I just we're paying for the shipping traffic that's going. What's the fee that these maritime pilots get? How do they get paid by the shippers, is my understanding, as they cost X to move a ship through the channel or over the bar or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, yes, what they are allowed to charge is set by tariff. We have a tariff that we generate after the rate making process, and those amounts are based upon usually the gross tonnage of the vessel and the draft of the vessel.
I think the testimony yesterday was they make $155,000 or more a year, and we limit the amount of licenses that are available. I'm wondering what the cost is to shippers. I'm also thinking that, you know, we're being asked right now to pay a lot of money to dredge the channel and do all that stuff. And is that all that money going into the, that we're charging this tariff, is all that money going into the pockets of the maritime pilots, or predominantly? Is there any money available for the state to dredge the channel and do the upkeep and do those kinds of things rather than it all going to the pilots, when we're asking to put up $10-$30 million for the dredging of the channel? That's what we're trying to get.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, the tariff generates solely enough revenue to pay the target net income of the pilots and their expenses incurred in providing their service. It does not generate any additional revenues for things such as harbor maintenance and channel dredging.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Listen. Comparatively, I mean, what do other pilots do? We've kind of created this industry that's closed by the amount of licenses these people make. I mean, that's a lot of money that they make. I don't know if it's a high risk job. It doesn't appear to be a super high risk job, but I don't know. They can probably do it forever and a day in terms of being able to do it. I don't think there's probably a limited time frame that you can do it. And I'm trying to justify, if we have 66 pilots?
Yes, sir, at this time.
66 pilots making $155,000 or more a year. And I'm just trying to, it's amazing to me.
Let me ask you, Susan, this is a statutory cap on the amount of pilots?
Mr. Chair, no, the number of pilots is essentially limited by the amount of shipping traffic. There are only so many jobs that shipping traffic exiting and entering our port So essentially, it is limited by the shipping traffic. On the other hand, the more pilots you have available, the less they have to work, the less work there is for each individual pilot on an FTE basis.
Your bottom line question is this a function that the state should be regulating the monopoly on some jobs?
Oh.
And that's a question probably the Substantive Committee should address, but I have had a long time concern over this. It's a limited entry system that protects a few at the expense of all. And the shipping companies go ahead and pay it. And it appears to be somewhat of a sweetheart deal. Nobody complains about it. But I complain about it because I think sweetheart deals are wrong anytime, any place. Representative Patrick.
This is a different line of follow-up questions, too. My concern also is, my understanding is that the board makes a determination whether an investigation is going to go forward, and not all these incidents are investigated. There's not any kind of independent investigator that's out there in terms of the board can hire one. But I'm concerned with what's happened recently and all those things. You told me yesterday that after the meeting that there was the board's looking at hiring an independent investigator, but I don't feel like I don't know if they're going to do that. I'd like to see that maybe included to look at as a budget note in terms of them having an independent investigator. It's costing the state of Oregon millions of dollars to deal with this, what happened with the nuclear store and other things. For the sake of an investigator for a little bit of money, I think that that's prudent to make the public feel good and make other people feel better.
Rick David Patrick raised a good question that I think is not so much a substantive question as it is a fiscal question, and that's the issue of the dredging of the Columbia and where the money comes from, and whether or not some of that should be figured into the tariff. And I think that's a legitimate question for discussion. In terms of risks to pilots, I represent a lot of the bar pilots, the Columbia River bar pilots, and I have told them repeatedly, I think they're all crazy. You try climbing up the side of a ship in 40 mile an hour winds and rough seas on one of the worst bars in the world. I mean, they get paid a lot of money. You couldn't pay me enough to do that. It's not to criticize what the river pilots do. I mean, they still climb up the middle of the ship in the middle of the night and you know, all that sort of thing, and sometimes in rough waters, but I think the Columbia River pilots do something most of us would never in the world want to do, but they are well compensated for it.
And this is for
Senator Lim.
It's a 24-hour waiting job. You come in the morning, they come in. And I used to be a ship supplier, so somewhat I have inside knowledge of it. They have to go through the channel about 6 to 7 hours. It's very dangerous. And it's a special skill. I think it is just sort of getting much amount of money for the job. That's my question.
Is there any finishing comments you'd like to give us? What we're going to do is hold this back and deal with the overall ODOT budget and work session. And this is just one component of it. But if there are some finishing comments, we'd be interested in hearing those.
I suppose this is just entering into my fourth biennium in this job, and I have had the pleasure of working with 18 different board members on this governor-appointed board, and they have dealt with some very difficult issues. It seems like every time we tackle an issue, every sinful solution seems to create even more problems than they seem to solve in the beginning, and I'm here to compliment their efforts and to support what they do. And I thank you for giving me an opportunity to get out on this beautiful day.
Any other comments or questions?
Just one question I have.
Thank
you very much. Concerning the helicopter, how you call it, taking the pilot to the ship,
are we planning that at some time in the near future, a pilot program, and do we know it will save some money or like it's going to cost more?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, we recently concluded a rate hearing in which the bar pilots petitioned the board to support their adoption of transferring from a boat-based pilot transfer system to a combination small fast boat and helicopter transfer system. The board has looked upon this with a lot of reservations because we're not sure what the efficiencies are going to be. We're not sure if the cost of the system is going to be offset by efficiencies. Therefore, the board has allowed a two-year test beginning this biennium, which will be very heavily tracked. We have a two-page set of parameters of all the conditions that we want tracked. The money is going to be separately accounted for. We want to know exactly where it's going, how much is being spent, how many ships are being served by this system. So we hope that in 2 years or less, we will have a definitive answer to your question.
Is anyone looking into the allegation that the new Carissa Cook would not have beached had we been able to helicopter a pilot out there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, yes, the board has looked into that, and based upon the severe weather conditions that the new Carissa encountered during that situation, no, a helicopter would not have made any difference. Even if a helicopter could have gotten out to the vessel and deposited a pilot on board, the conditions were too severe for the vessel to come in across the bar. It would not have been a prudent undertaking.
I'm ready to have a work session.
Pardon me?
Are we going to have a work session?
No, we're going to have a work session when we do the overall ODOT.
All together?
Right.
Okay.
We just wanted to have a hearing on the different components.
Okay.
Tomorrow morning, we will meet after a full Ways and Means Committee, and I apologize we have to meet on Friday, but we need to move ahead with our schedule to keep on course. And it'll be zero-based budgeting tomorrow.
For sure.
So everything you wanted to know or didn't want to know about zero-based budgeting will be available to you tomorrow.
Same time?
It'll be immediately upon conclusion of the full Ways and Means.
What time is it?
8 o'clock. And typically it's over between 8:15 and 8:20. Okay. If so, we are adjourned till tomorrow.